from the Media Broadcasting Center.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, where I have a wonderful guest, Jim Condit Jr., who's very savvy politically. He's even running for Congress himself, but the traffic is heavy and he's been delayed. So to create a buffer, I want to introduce you to the candidate that we all should be concerned about. She is a dominating presence on the Democratic side. There's no doubt that elections are being stolen from Bernie Sanders to benefit Hillary Clinton. And in order for you to understand what we're up against here and why this election is so important, I have a video from Abby Martin of Russia Today, who gives a very objective discussion of the history of Hillary Clinton, which everyone, every American needs to understand. So we're going to take a short break for a chance to set it up and get it going. And after the documentary, after the Abby Martin, I'll have Jim Condit here and we'll go from there. Stand by.
Moonrock Books. We're a group of scholars, experts, and authors who feel the world really needs saving and that resisting the American empire is the right thing to do. People are starved for truth. They are given lies. They subsist on lies, but it's not really living. People are not watching TV news. They're ceasing to read newspapers, too, because they know by now they will not find it there. The biggest battle being fought anywhere is with information. If the people can receive the truth, they will do the right thing. We are publishing the truth about Sandy Hook, about the Boston bombing, about the moon landings, about the Holocaust, and much, much more. The truth. It falls upon us to fight the empire and save the world. Join us, Moonrock Books.
As the circus of the 2016 presidential election grinds on, Hillary Clinton has posited herself as the candidate of the people. But not many candidates of the people have vacation homes in the Hamptons that cost $200,000 per month, or hang out with the world's billionaires. You know, it's hard to know who she really is. While once being a proponent of Donald Trump-type positions, like building a wall at the Mexican border, supporting torture, and opposing same-sex marriage until 2013, today, Hillary Clinton presents herself as the anti-Trump, anti-Republican candidate. There's been a lot of outrage about the impression that the establishment has already anointed her as the Democratic nominee and has carved out her path to the presidency. But like in 2008, her guaranteed seat on the throne is being derailed by the unpredictable moods of the masses and millions of young progressive voters. She continues to play her shape-shifting game, morphing her positions to try to capture the support from her opponent. But the real Hillary is still inside. In fact, every layer of Hillary's career shows why. Far from being a candidate of the people, she's the top pick by corporations to do the real job of any U.S. president, be the CEO of the empire. And they're working hard to keep her on that path to the throne. Having been party insiders for decades, the Clintons have manipulated D.C. reporters, mastered the media spin, and have a well-oiled PR machine at their beck and call.
Hillary Clinton has done everything right. She has run a good campaign. She has outperformed in debates. She's raised money. She's got a great ground game.
As a Latina, I can tell you that Latinos all over the country are very excited about Hillary. Latina women are very excited about Hillary.
Knew from the beginning that when the conversation turned to foreign policy, that this was going to be when Hillary Clinton really shined. And I think that that whole exchange was probably one of her strongest moments of the night.
Undisclosed is that many of the people praising Hillary across the corporate media work at firms employed by Clinton's campaign and super PACs. It's not just paid pundits, but the reporters and owners themselves. From Chris Matthews to the head of the New York Times, a big gang of media personalities have financial and personal ties to the Clintons. But even with Citizens United and unfettered corporate funding, the establishment can't prevent an insurgent candidate like Bernie Sanders from winning with votes, which is why back in 1984, the Democratic Party created a superdelegate process to further undermine democracy. Here's how it works. There's about 4,000 pledged delegates divided by primary and caucus results. But there's an additional 700 superdelegates that remain unpledged, meaning they can vote against the people's will to ensure nominees are handpicked party insiders. The single vote of a superdelegate is worth thousands of ours. Many of these people are current and former members of Congress, but dozens more are literally corporate lobbyists, working on behalf of every industry from healthcare to private prisons. Like superdelegate Tonio Burgos, Pfizer lobbyist and Clinton fundraiser. Or superdelegates Jill Alpler, Minion Moore, and Maria Cardona at Dewey Square Group, a lobbying firm that works directly with the Clinton campaign and lobbied on behalf of healthcare corporations to craft Obamacare for their benefit. Then there's superdelegate Jeff Berman, top lobbyist at Brian Cave, and former lobbyist for the Keystone XL Pipeline and Geo Group private prisons. Berman is even paid by the Clintons to round up other superdelegate votes. This unelected nobility comprises one-third of all delegates needed to secure the Democratic nomination. And the Clintons are surrounded by a flock of Democratic Party politicians who know the career benefits of hitching their wagon to the most powerful family in Washington. And with bills cajoling, Hillary had at least 500 superdelegate pledges under her belt months before the election had even begun. A 45-1 delegate lead over Sanders. This insane Democratic inversion plays out every time Sanders crushes a state, like in Wyoming, where he won by double digits but walked away with the same number of delegates. It's not just superdelegates investing in Hillary. Every arm of the corporatocracy has been hedging their bets on her for almost two decades. Alongside media conglomerates Cablevision and Time Warner, five of Hillary's top 10 political donors since 1999 have been some of the most powerful banks. Citigroup, Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan Chase, Morgan Stanley, and Lehman Brothers. But those numbers pale in comparison to how much Wall Street firms have graciously donated to Hillary's super PAC, to the tune of $15 million. Beyond banks, every industry has been buying into another Clinton presidency. Lobbying groups for private prison giants Geo Group and Corrections Corporation of America are bundling dollars to the Ready for Hillary PAC. Hillary's also been given more money from Big Pharma than any other candidate, and received over a third of total contributions given out by pharmaceutical giants. The defense industry thinks she's good for business, too. Defense contractor employees have given her more cash than any other candidate. Fossil fuel lobbyists are also working hard to elect Hillary. Her 2016 campaign received more than $4.5 million from lobbyists, bundlers, and donors connected to the world's biggest polluters. Their investment will pay off tenfold. Hillary has been at the forefront of promoting fracking, a dangerous and destructive method of natural gas extraction. And she's much more than just a supporter of fracking. She personally created a bureau at the State Department focused on spreading it around the world with one of her major sponsors, Chevron. The Clintons sell their friendship through other avenues, such as huge honorariums for speaking fees. Much like George W. Bush's motivational speaking tour, Bill and Hillary are quick to exploit themselves for corporate loot. But they don't come cheap. Averaging $211,000 a pop, Bill and Hillary made more than $153 million in paid speeches to elite think tanks and closed-door boardrooms since 2001. In 2013, the year after leaving the State Department, Hillary made $3 million giving just 12 speeches to Wall Street banks and financial institutions. This calculates to her earning $5,000 per minute. Seems like good, honest work to me. Demands to release the speech transcripts have been laughed off by Hillary. But we don't really need to see the transcripts because we already know what's in them. Her praising banks and committing to their prosperity. Although Hillary has recently tried to appear critical of Wall Street to pander to Sanders' immense support, her fat cat banker donors aren't worried in the slightest, saying her talking points about inequality are, quote, just politics. But how did Hillary Clinton become such a political force that the empire's biggest powerhouses and establishment elites flocked to her with money and support? Hillary was born in 1947 to a wealthy textile wholesaler who unsuccessfully ran for public office. She has two brothers, one a failed businessman, the other a failed politician. Both have their own history of public scandals. Hillary's first political work was campaigning for the Donald Trump of the 60s, far-right Republican Barry Goldwater. Hillary maintains that she was proud to be a Goldwater girl and writes off her support for the offensive character as just youthful ignorance. But the timing tells a different story. This was in 1964, when the Civil Rights Act was passed, after the Freedom Rides, after MLK's I Have a Dream speech at the historic March on Washington. Goldwater's campaign was an open reaction to that. Later, Hillary became president of the Young Republicans Club at her elite university. She says she later transformed, which is a common thing for Hillary, but her conservative past is more tied to her rise than she wants you to know. The Clintons' climb to prominence had everything to do with the political climate in the country. During the Civil Rights period, the Republican Party emerged as the new choice for racist whites. Reagan's sweeping victories in the South, ushering in 12 years of Republican administrations, put the Democratic Party in a panic. A younger movement within the party formed to win back the Southern vote, known as the New Democrats. And it did so through a conservative shift, canceling out hallmark Great Society economic policies and appealing to anti-black attitudes by distancing themselves from prominent black Democrats, targeting mythical welfare queens, and pushing so-called criminal reforms that targeted African Americans.
They're a new generation of Democrats, Bill Clinton and Al Gore, and they don't think the way the old Democratic Party did. They've called for an end to welfare as we know it, so welfare can be a second chance, not a way of life. They've sent a strong signal to criminals by supporting the death penalty.
Bill swept the Southern white vote on his ending welfare as we know it and tough on crime coded racism.
We're making some progress. Much of it is related to the initiative called community policing, because we have finally gotten more police officers on the street. That was one of the goals that the president had when he pushed the crime bill that was passed in 1994. They are not just gangs of kids anymore. They are often the kinds of kids that are called super predators. No conscience, no empathy. We can talk about why they ended up that way, but first we have to bring them to heel.
Hillary Clinton tries to rationalize her support for these measures today as having unintended consequences. But they were precisely designed to target African Americans. At the helm of a right turn for the party, politicians flocked to the Clintons, which brought a new era of Democratic Party politics, adapting to the changing needs of empire. Neoliberalism was enacted through NAFTA, decimating American jobs and economies abroad. Massive deregulation of Wall Street and the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act set the stage for an economic crisis. Clinton's crime bill exploded our shameful era of mass incarceration. When the Clintons left the White House in 1999, their rise to political powerhouses was really just the beginning, despite Bill's numerous sexual harassment cases. With a plan to put Hillary in the Oval Office next, they moved to their new home state of New York, where Hillary became a senator the following year. While wealthy, the Clintons had nowhere near the money they have today. On their 1999 tax returns, they made less than $500,000. But by 2014, they were making more than 50 times that amount, reporting over $28 million in income. And that only scratches the surface of the cash supplies they've amassed. While Hillary went to work crafting a presidential resume in the Senate, Bill capitalized on his new super elite status as a former president. And the Clintons' way of cashing in on that access was by exploiting misery and disaster. In 2001, in response to a major earthquake in India, the Clintons joined the heads of Goldman Sachs and Citibank and embarked on a false philanthropy model that would define their Clinton Foundation. These development and relief charities act as an insertion needle for Western business. For example, some of the Clinton Foundation's so-called development projects in India, Africa, and Central America include forming for-profit farming corporations that exploit small farmers. The donations typically end up back in the pockets of donors, their companies getting the so-called development contracts to build up mobile networks and real estate. In the past 15 years, the Clinton Foundation has grown into a lucrative fraternity of the rich and powerful, which boasts of having projects in 180 different countries. Including its numerous spin-off affiliates, it reported total assets of over $351 million in 2013. The sources of cash for this political machine say everything about the true nature of this charity. As a nonprofit, the Clinton Foundation is not required to disclose donors or contributions. All of the funds disclosed on the website are in ranges and unspecified for what purpose. Other than a $25 million partnership with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the Clinton Foundation's large donor base is a motley crew of criminal corporations and police state monarchies. Giving a gracious $10 million is the brutal theocratic kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Matching the $10 million is the Victor Pinchuk Foundation, Ukrainian billionaire oligarch who pledged tens of millions more to the Clinton Global Initiative to, quote, modernize Ukraine while Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State, donating in the $1 to $5 million range are Gulf state monarchies Oman, the United Arab Emirates, Qatar and Kuwait, Saudi billionaire Nasir al-Rashid, ExxonMobil, Dow Chemical, Walmart, a company she has close ties to, having served on their board of directors from 1986 to 1992, Coca-Cola, Pfizer, Barclays Capital, Goldman Sachs, and Boeing, the number two defense contractor in the country. In the lower million-dollar range are such exemplary institutions as Monsanto, Chevron, General Electric, more banks, Bank of America, Citigroup, Morgan Stanley, UBS, Bank of California, and media giant Fox's News Corp. Then there's the Soros Foundation, an organization that claims to build, quote, tolerant democracies around the world, whatever that means. It's a win-win relationship, one that only continues to grow. The Clintons get massive financial support to run their machine, and their contributors get the perks of a loyal advocate in a position of power. As Hillary ascends off of this corporate sponsorship, the more favors she can grant, leading to more contributions, and so on. And while Hillary was in the Senate, these favors for her donors were numerous. Manufacturing giant known as Corning gave hundreds of thousands to the Clintons through their foundation and speaking fees. In return, Hillary introduced Senate legislation to allot hundreds of millions in federal aid to purchase Corning products. Notorious criminal enterprises Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae were also Clinton Foundation sponsors who won big by investing in Senator Clinton. She played a key role in blocking measures to regulate them, helping them reap super profits before facilitating the crash of the economy. The deal was good for business while Hillary was in the Senate, but the plan was always something bigger. After checking the box of having experience and having built a robust financial backing and political network, Hillary announced her bid for president in 2006, shortly after her Senate re-election. She was supposed to be the shoo-in. It was her time, as they said. But then everything blew up in her face. Mass opposition to the Iraq War marginalized her as a candidate. A little-known Barack Obama was flung to the front for his rhetoric against the war, while Hillary ardently defended her vote for the war throughout her entire campaign. Knocked off a presumed ride to the White House, she flailed trying to capture a changing Democratic Party base. Her campaign was criticized for its slew of dirty tricks, including an array of voter suppression tactics mainly aimed at the youth. Most pathetic was the release of a photo of Obama in a turban, pandering to Islamophobia and the strategy of thinly veiled racism the Clintons employed back in the 90s. Obama's campaign manager, David Plouffe, said the photo was the most shameful, offensive fear-mongering we've seen from either party in this election. But none of the schemes worked. And while today Hillary's media surrogates continue to call on close competitor Bernie Sanders to drop out, back in 2008 she held out to the very bitter end, refusing to give in when Obama was the clear winner. She only acquiesced and backed Obama after a closed-door negotiation where she was promised a promotion and a path to succeed him. As Secretary of State, the rewards for her sponsors grew to a new level, and so too did donations to the Clintons. Her corruption is exemplified by the fact that 181 donors to the Clinton Foundation simultaneously lobbied the State Department while she was in charge. She used her position to divvy out repayment favors in a variety of ways. She funneled money from the State Department to Clinton friends and sponsors, like securing tens of millions in government grants for her dear friend and owner of for-profit education firm, Lorette Education, Inc. She also used her new title to help negotiate business deals between her donor friends and other heads of state. For example, she brought billionaire mining magnate Frank Giostra to meet the president of Colombia, scoring him access to pristine forests and coastline to be mined and drilled by his company. She did the same in Kazakhstan and beyond. Hillary convinced other countries to give up permits to be pillaged. In one incident, she convinced the Haitian government to issue a rare mining permit. The contract went out to a mining company that not only shells out millions to the Clinton Foundation, but her brother sits on its board of directors. She also flew around the world on the taxpayer's dime to act as a saleswoman for American corporations. For her sponsor Boeing, she made a personal pitch to the Russian government to purchase their jets. The result was a $3.7 billion contract for Boeing. The Clintons got a kickback of $900K as a giant thank you from the war profiteer. But none of these deals compare to her role as an international arms dealer. Her State Department approved a whopping $165 billion worth of commercial arms sales to 20 nations that are also Clinton Foundation sponsors, doubling U.S. arms sales to those countries under George W. Bush. These lucrative deals are undeniably rewards for paying off the Clintons. The amount of the reward directly corresponded to the amount of their donation. Her top donor, Saudi Arabia, scored the biggest, and so on down the line. Beyond the obvious step up from her corporate shilling as Senator and Secretary of State, wreaking economic and environmental havoc to line the pockets of Clinton coffers, a President Hillary puts us in great danger of catastrophic war, another fact she's proven time and again over the entirety of her career. Clinton's war record is perhaps most exemplified by her endorsement from one of the world's most notorious war criminals, the Butcher of Cambodia, Henry Kissinger. On the campaign trail, she bragged, "I was very flattered when Henry Kissinger said I ran the State Department better than anybody had run it in a long time. So I have an idea about what it's going to take to make our government work more efficiently." Yes, the relationship between Kissinger and Clinton is very close. Not only did she consult with him regularly as Secretary of State, her and Bill frequently vacationed with the Kissingers. Her other foreign policy advisors are quite similar, including PNAC founder neoconservative Robert Kagan, and even shares advisors with Republican war hawks like Ted Cruz. Her support for the criminal invasion of Iraq has come back to haunt her once again in this election, and now she's written it off as a mistake, and in one instance seemed to blame it on being bribed by George Bush with state funds for New York.
So I'm sitting there in the Oval Office, and Bush says to me, "What do you need?" I said, "I need $20 billion to rebuild, New York." He said, "You got it," and he was good to his word.
But she didn't just vote for the war. She was a key advocate of it, leading a right-wing minority among Democratic Party Congress members that favored the invasion over the old tactics of empire's domination. She called for, quote, unequivocal support for Bush's firm leadership and decisive action. She spread the lie that Iraq was in violation of UN resolutions, despite the actual weapons inspectors arguing the contrary, and continued to assert Iraq had WMDs despite it being, by that time, thoroughly debunked. As the U.S. and Iraqi body count grew and complete disaster ensued, Hillary still went around the country asserting that she had no regrets giving Bush total authority to invade and occupy Iraq. In 2007, she voted to give Bush the same authority again, with a blank check to attack Iran by trying to label their military a terrorist organization, a move rejected even by pro-war Democrats.
Today, Joe Lieberman, who authored the Iraq resolution, has offered another resolution, and it is essentially a fig leaf to let George Bush go to war with Iran. And I want to congratulate Biden for voting against it, Dodd for voting against it, and I'm ashamed of you, Hillary, for voting for it. You're not going to get another shot at this, because what's happened, if this war ensues, we invade, and they're looking for an excuse to do it. And Obama was not even there to vote.
Senator Clinton, I want to give you a chance to respond.
In 2008, Senator Clinton made the chilling and completely repulsive admission that if president, she would not rule out using nuclear weapons on Afghanistan and Pakistan. After her promotion to Secretary of State, she boldly planted a flag in the Obama administration to establish the Hillary Doctrine. According to The Nation, 24 current and former administration officials, foreign diplomats, friends, and outside analysts described Mrs. Clinton as almost always the advocate of the most aggressive actions considered by Mr. Obama's national security team. Of course, she joined Obama in creating and leading terrible fronts to human life and rights, like the murderous drone campaign in Pakistan, Yemen, and Somalia. The program's mass civilian casualties, she says, she takes with a grain of salt. However, on other issues, she took the lead, showing how she would steer the empire's ship as she aimed for the presidency. In her book, she brags about her lead role back in the 2009 coup of the democratically elected leader in Honduras, further plunging the country into violence and instability. Also that year, when it was long clear that the Afghanistan war was an endless, unwinnable crisis, she lobbied to send far more troops in Obama's blood-soaked troop surge. When it was time to keep the promise of bringing those troops home, then Secretary of Defense Robert Gates says that Hillary argued forcefully against withdrawing the surge troops. She continues to advocate a never-ending U.S. occupation there. The same thing happened when it came to Iraq. Hillary led a minority that tried to convince Obama to leave thousands more American combat troops there, permanently. Today, she's to the right of Obama on Iraq yet again, advocating for even more U.S. troops, more combat. Then came what has been dubbed Hillary's War, a move Obama recently admitted was his biggest mistake. Oil-rich Libya is where Clinton sought to showcase her military doctrine. Masked and sinister right-to-protect jargon, Hillary is well known as the primary advocate for U.S.-led attack to overthrow the Libyan state, to feed on its resources and hijack the Arab Spring.
As we came, we saw, he died.
She laughed about an African leader being lynched on television, his country tossed into an era of unimaginable pain. Right afterward, what everyone predicted happened. Strife from a shattered state, decimated infrastructure, and U.S. armed rebel fighters has turned Libya into a new bastion for ISIS. The scandal of Benghazi isn't that Hillary allowed Americans to die, but that those Americans were there funneling weapons to extremists in a country she had just helped destroy. And what did Hillary take away from the incident? That there should have been more American troops.
We have learned the hard way. When America is absent, especially from unstable places, there are consequences.
Yeah, I don't think it was because America was absent, but because they had just carpet-bombed the country and injected its entire government. And on Syria, she's led the push for war from the beginning. She personally joined the shame general David Petraeus in creating the CIA-led Friends of Syria insurgency. She was among the first and most forceful in pushing for a no-fly zone to overthrow the Syrian state. Even as recently as 2015, she had a high-profile break with Obama over the issue, and even in recent debates had to continue to advocate for it. A no-fly zone means war. It means U.S. bombing of all Syrian anti-aircraft defense systems, and much more. It would undoubtedly trigger a broader regional conflict involving nuclear powers. When it comes to Israel, she has rebuked Obama on the most mild criticisms of Israeli war crimes, and vows to give the occupation more aid than any other candidate. But the biggest apparent danger of a regime under the Hillary Doctrine is the risk of new U.S. wars. If Hillary was a proud leader of what's accepted as the biggest foreign policy catastrophes of both the Bush and Obama administrations, what else should be expected of a Hillary administration? Well, one little discussed threat posed by a Hillary presidency is that she spent her time in office paving the way for war with Iran. When asked in a recent Democratic debate what enemy she was most proud to have, she answered, the Iranians. In the 2008 campaign, she was ostracized for her aggressive comments about Iran.
They might be in their nuclear weapons program in the next 10 years, during which they might foolishly consider launching an attack on Israel. We would be able to totally obliterate them.
She's always advocated the most hawkish approaches to Iran. But in recent years, she's made a point to separate herself from Obama as the more strong-armed and the sly war by sanctions and subversion. With the signing of the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, Obama was staunch in refusing to threaten Iran with a military attack if they violated the agreement. However, Hillary went over his head to show her sword was sharper, declaring her position on television. We will not hesitate to take military action if Iran attempts to obtain a nuclear weapon. Given her proud support for a war of aggression for non-existent WMDs in Iraq, no one should trust her standards. Nobody doubts that a U.S. war with Iran would likely be catastrophic and wider reaching than the Iraq War. This great danger facing the lives of countless people around the world should never be understated. But it's not just Iran. In every part of the world, from Latin America to Asia, Hillary Clinton has made clear that she will choose the path of death and destruction every time, no matter the consequences. We know they're going to use fear of the Republican nominee to pressure everyone into supporting her. They don't want us to know that we can and we should fight both sides. And as a woman, I completely reject Hillary's brand of bourgeois feminism because it leaves out millions of immigrant women, poor women, and the women under her bombs around the world.
This is Jim Fetzer, and I'm delighted to say Jim Condit Jr. has arrived, and that it was tremendously valuable, I think, to have Abby Martin go through the background of Hillary, because the American people have to begin to understand this woman is actually a monster. We'll have more to say about it. But, Jim, I'm just delighted to have you here. Welcome to The Real Deal.
Thanks for having me, Dr. Fetzer. I appreciate it.
Oh, please do just call me Jim.
Oh, okay.
Now, you're running for Congress this year to replace John Boehner. Tell us about that. How'd you get in this position?
Well, I mean, I've done it a few times when he was in order to you know, obviously you hope to win, and you got to be careful these days because the FCC and the stations try to, if you say something like, I don't think I have a good chance to win, they will try to use that, or they have used it in one person's case to say, well, you're not a real candidate. And then they have tried to not allow the candidate to take advantage of the reasonable access law. The reasonable access law says that any federal candidate, Congress, Senate, President, if you can buy ads in the same deal that they give to businesses the rest of the year, in the last 60 days before an election, then they have to accept your ad, and they have to accept the content. They can't modify the content, okay? So I have a special election because John Boehner resigned at that odd time last year. So there's a special election coming in on June 7th to fill out his six-month term. And then I'm on the ballot again in November to fill out his two-year term. So, of course, anyone would like to win, but I'm probably being outspent several million dollars to several thousand dollars. So what we can do is when we can afford to buy it and people help us, then we can afford to buy actual 60-second commercials on WLW, which is the largest radio station in the Midwest and around Cincinnati. And that reaches a 90-mile radius. And we can buy our programs on Sunday afternoon on WKRC, which is a 50,000 watch station where Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity is on, and Glenn Beck and Mark Levin. So
fantastic.
We're right on these 50,000 watch. And on Sunday afternoon, it's not ideal, but that's the only day they sell to businesses. Okay. So it's not ideal, but there are tens of thousands. I mean, 30, 40, 50,000 cars on the streets at 2 p.m. on Sunday, 2 to 3. And a lot of these people are used to listening to talk radio, so they'll be tuned in. And if they are too shocked at what we're saying, then they'll stay tuned in, and then we send them the websites that lead them to other websites, you know. So
yeah.
This is confronting the enemy, you might say, in the public arena. Now, the reason I went into this a little bit is I wish someone would do this in every city. You know, it took me, thanks to our Ohio Secretary of State, it took me 25 signatures to get on the ballot, valid signatures. Other areas, it varies from state to state. Or you can run as a write-in. It still applies to you as a write-in because, remember, they claim that this hideous Senator Barbara Murkowski up in Alaska won by a write-in vote, which I don't believe for a minute, but they claim she won by a write-in vote because she was defeated by a real conservative named Joe Miller. And so they claim, and there's been four or five other cases for Congress in the last 30 years, including one as recent as 2004, where a write-in candidate has won. So you can just sign a piece of paper in Ohio, pay $80 or whatever it is around there in every state. And now you've got the right, if you can raise the money, to put ads on. And when I put one on WLW, Jim, in the middle of drive time, advertising my Sunday show or just doing anything, they claim between 150 and 300,000 people hear it. And I believe them because WLW never has ad time unsold. They always have 20 minutes of ads every
year. Well, what's terrific is you're reaching exactly your target audience.
Exactly. And we're also reaching, we hope, there's got to be always thousands of people in every area that are locked into the Fox News, Sean Hannity type of thing, who are saying to themselves, at least subconsciously, am I getting the full story here? You know what I mean? After they hear it, a lot of people think, I wonder if they're giving me the full story. Well, we come on and say they're not giving you the full story, and here's where you go to get the full story. And my website this year is letfreedomring2016.com. It kind of rhymes.
Yeah.
Letfreedomring2016.com. And then we shortly will have up the three radio shows we did before the March 15th primary, because we did three full radio shows then. And one of the things we covered, one of my commercials said, in fact, if you want, I could even play it at some point in this, because I played it over this mic before and it works well. But the one of the ads started out by saying, here comes the computer vote fraud against Trump. That's how it started. And it was before the Ohio primary. And I said, if John Kasich, the governor of Ohio, if they claim he wins this primary, that will only happen by massive computer fraud against Trump.
So even Kasich's victory in Ohio was because of computer fraud. Just as right here in Wisconsin, where I am, the Cruz victory over Trump was again because of computer fraud. This is really unbelievable, Jim. It's just getting disgusting beyond belief.
Well, and most people, it's almost they can't handle it because they then realize that we're, as long as these computers stay in, we're pretty powerless. And most people don't want to admit that. Now, that isn't to say that all elections are fixed. I've never said all elections are, but I'm saying when you have a critical election and they can make it believable. Jim Collier, who you got this, at least I'm looking at a slide of his book up on the screen, Vote Scam, The Stealing of America by James and Ken.
Right. Let me check with Chance. Chance, do we have that slide up on the screen?
Oh, it doesn't. You don't have to. It was up.
No. I want to get my slides up. And Chance, I've got a glitch here. I can't get them to move. I can't advance them. Do you have them all there? Yeah, go ahead and set it up while Jim and I talk. But just put up this one, if you don't mind, with, yeah, that first slide, Vote Scam, The Stealing of America. Tell me more, Jim.
Well, Jim Collier, Ken and Jim both died of cancer in their 50s, in the 90s. Ken died, I believe, in 1993, a year after this book, or shortly after this book came out, which was the original big book on computerized vote scam, which had been building up since the 70s and finally was perfected across the country, except in New Hampshire by 1988. Okay. And that's where they start the book Bush the Elder saying the people have spoken, and they say, no, the computers have spoken silently, wow, unverified. It's a beautiful passage, but that they wrote about this. But the point is, he used to say, once the computers get in, they can make anything happen as long as it's believable. Now, let me take an example, because I'm sure people want to relate this to what's happening right now. Jim Trafficant was, in my opinion, probably the most courageous congressman of this last generation. He spent 7 years in jail for nothing. And Mike Piper wrote a book about that called, Target Trafficant. Okay. If anybody wants to look into the trials and how there were nothing, they didn't have anything on him. They excluded the evidence that would have helped him. And it's worse than that. It's worse than that. They may have killed somebody to get somebody off the jury, or it was one of those beautiful coincidences for the establishment of a young guy who's 22 year old, carpenter apprentice who said, I'm not voting to convict Trafficant, okay? But I'm just saying, Trafficant, despite what people may have heard, was a great guy. I traveled the last six or seven speeches of his life, 6 or 7 hours a trip with him before he died under really quizzical circumstances on his farm in a tractor accident.
Jim, they're knocking off people all the time, and they're finding more subtle ways to do it. I'm even suspicious that Prince was knocked off to get the 28 pages and Obama going to Saudi Arabia to kiss their ass off of the front page.
That could be. But anyway, Trafficant, he won when he was running before he went to prison. He was winning by 80% and 90% of the vote. Okay. And 1 year, I believe he got more votes in his congressional district than the Republican candidate for governor did. And that's in a statewide race. So Trafficant, they never ran anybody against Trafficant except for like a token person. That's who the Democrats are putting up a token person in my race in the 8th district this time, because it's a Republican district, and the guy Warren Davis, who's running as a Republican, has millions of dollars behind him. He's a former Army Ranger, nice looking guy. But I'm afraid I'm going to be in at least two debates with him, apparently. And I'm going to try to warn him as I talk to the audience. He's going into a job. He doesn't want to go up there and sell his soul like Boehner and Kasich have done, right? So yeah. I want to try to warn these guys, but most of them are neocons and the whole bit. But at any rate, getting back to trafficking. So they didn't even we had a sheriff named Simon Lease here who was retired a few years ago. He would get a large percentage of the vote. They, in other words, it's not believable to say that Joe Hippie with hair down to his rear end defeats a sheriff who's popular with the people. So they don't do stupid things like that. But when they can make it believable. Now, when Trafficant got out of prison 7 years later, they, of course, ran. He was out of prison and they didn't cover him. And they emphasized he was in prison. And they claimed he lost that election 60 to 40. Okay, 60% to 40%. I don't believe he lost it. The people I talk up there said that everybody they talked to all over the place like Trafficant. So it's just like even if some people thought he was guilty, which maybe they did, they still want to rebel against the teacher, and they knew Trafficant told it like it was. So I'm just saying, they don't do things unless it can be believable. Now, what they've used in this Trump race is that the magic of the home state. Okay, so they claimed that Ted Cruz won his home state in Texas. Nobody I know in Texas believes that. The people I know who are very well-informed people, they say that all over the state, people were talking about nothing but Trump in restaurants, in banks, and nobody believes Cruz won Texas. And I can run through real quickly why I think there's quite a bit of circumstantial evidence that obvious that Kasich did not win Ohio. Kasich is not popular in Ohio. I know they're telling people all over.
It's like Scott Walker isn't popular in Wisconsin. I mean,
Kasich is despised. He has hacked everybody off across the board one way or the other. He's not an impressive figure. Somebody said he looks like a tired old dad from the 50s that worked till 11 o'clock and has just got out of work to go. He's not an impressive figure. Now, we're not supposed to believe our lying eyes, but when Trump flew into Ohio on the Saturday before the primary was on March 15th, so this would have been the 12th, he comes into Dayton at 10 a.m. and gets 20,000 people in Dayton, which is 60 miles north of where I am in Cincinnati, okay? He then flies up to Cleveland 4 hours later and gets 28,000 people. Now, Kasich, the sitting governor, who's been trying for months to get people to an event in Cincinnati that morning at the same time Trump spoke in Dayton, Kasich has an event at the Sharonville Convention Center, which is on the north side of Cincinnati in the suburbs. And I know somebody who went there who's a very reliable witness, who's not as into everything as we are, but a very kind of more mainstream political person. He went to this, and he's told my sister it was about 700 people. This was after months, and it was probably mostly county employees who kind of had to go because their boss was.
They were obligated, because they worked for the governor.
Very tepid applause, very polite applause, nothing. So do we believe our lying eyes, or do we believe?
Yeah.
Probably, now let's go to something else that happened in Ohio. Because even though the other side, the ruling elite, the Goldman Sachs Fed crowd, whatever, that's what I usually like to refer to them as, because the people that got the money to buy up all this media over the last 20 years are the international banks, Goldman Sachs, the Fed, the IMF. They're the people that have the ability to issue money, and really they have the ability to issue money in secret since the audits are non-existent or very sketchy.
Well, should I go to, I've got another slide about your talking about Heidi Cruz. Should we go to that number two? Flip it.
If you wish,
yeah. Go ahead, right, because you were going to talk about her. She's not only managing director at Goldman Sachs, but a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. This is unbelievable, Jim.
Well, you know, I have several good friends, but one good friend in particular who feeds me all kinds of information that I really need to get and don't have time to scan for myself with everything else going on. Now, you're probably like I am, that you've been in this so long, you rarely run into people that can tell you stuff you don't know. But I do have a few of those people. And so this guy sent me this, and I'm not shocked, I guess, but I was kind of amazed it was this bold. Here we got Heidi Cruz is in Goldman Sachs. They have, so it's not that she's the second highest person in Goldman Sachs. No, she's not that. But she's in the second highest category of position at Goldman Sachs. So maybe you have the the VPs next to
second level of executive directors.
Something like that. She's in a group of people that are right next to the vice. She's the second highest category of position. So this isn't like some secretary that just joined the team because she could type fast, you know? So now, in addition to that, which I just found out when I put this article a while ago from this excellent source, she writes one of 31 essays in a book in 2007, I believe. And it was called, it's all in the article, but I think it was called Towards the North American Union. Okay.
Oh, so no.
Here's so-called Mr. Patriotism, Mr. Constitution.
Is promoting the merger of Mexico, Canada, and the United States, so there's no more sovereignty.
And I'm also given to understand.
He's got to be with the TPP, which has the same effect, as you know, Jim.
Yeah, this is, free trade is freedom for the top.
Corporations.
Yeah, and for the top bankers to exploit everyone. In other words, they knock the jobs out of America. They treat the Chinese and the Mexicans as virtual slave labor, as if not slave labor, which is totally unnecessary in an age when, for all practical purposes, we have the computers and the machinery to produce unlimited physical good. Now, I'm not saying it really is unlimited, but I'm saying compared to 500 years ago, we can think of it as unlimited. So there's no reason that the United States goes up, but the Mexicans and the Chinese go down. No, there's no reason for that. Every country, this is another subject, Jim, but it's one of my favorites, because if money was issued right, every country could raise. Every country in the world could raise their standard of living, and we could, by sharing technology to those countries that don't have it, we could really be, you know, for Christians, let me just say this, you know how the right now they'll say, oh, well, in fact, they're knocking Patrick Henry off, Andrew Jackson off the $20 bill to the back, and they're saying, well, he owned slaves. Okay, he did, and that's wrong. The way slaves were treated in the United States, I mean, it's wrong, even if some of these guys treated their slaves right. So it was a blind spot in that generation, even though those are the guys that set up the system that eventually got rid of slavery in the United States, and when some, I think there's one country in Africa that still has slavery, but so that was a blind spot for that generation. But I think a blind spot for our generation, when people look back on our time, maybe see how come these developed countries had so much food and they weren't helping the countries that were starving some of the time, and that could be solved if we had. International bankers like you and me and other people that are doing these alternative programs, if we were running it, we could issue money properly to serve the people. And then within 4 months in this country and maybe 4 years in the world, every country could be raising up. So anyway, my only point is, Heidi Cruz and Ted Cruz are thick and thieves with these financial vultures at Goldman Sachs. You know, that Bernie Sanders has been hitting at least the problem right there. And so she's thick as thieves. He asked her to resign from both Goldman Sachs. I don't know that she's resigned from the Council on Foreign Relations. And I understand that he was Bush's main negotiator on preparing the groundwork for the North American Union. Ted Cruz, W. Bush's main negotiator.
Well, this is all disgusting beyond belief.
So, and he's running around that he's Mr. Constitution. And this is why one of my friends who's very well informed said to me the other day, he said, look, Jim, he said, I don't know if I agree with Trump exactly on anything. Most of the stuff he says, I disagree with him a little here and there, but he might shake things up. He might do something. He might reverse this TPP and all this stuff. And the others, we know when you pull the curtain back, we know they're all bought and paid for.
Right.
Cruz here. Right. Kasich is nobody is more. There may be people equal with him. But nobody is more bought than John Kasich, the governor of Ohio. His controller is Wexler of the Gap, the clothing store, and for years has been. And he is everything. He's in favor. He talks about fighting bullies. He joined up with the international banking establishment around the Fed and Goldman Sachs to bully every worker in America when he voted for NAFTA in 1994. The people didn't know it, but now they know it. There was this Carrier, I think it's called Carrier Air Conditioning up in Indiana, just announced they're closing and 800 jobs are going to Mexico. This is thanks to John Kasich and John Boehner and Paul Ryan, all these people that have supported all of these NAFTA-type deals every step of the way. This is Pat Buchanan has a book called The Great Betrayal, and I would say is the great portrayal. Now, let me relate this just quickly back to this show. These votes, when we're talking about getting an honest count, when you do have a candidate that looks like he can provide some hope for the people, this is not just a theory. This is not just something like, boy, I wonder if we have the best possible voting system, which is important to think about. This is who wins, who is the published computer winners of these elections are going to control the future of your city, your county, your state, our country, and the world. This is everything's on the line here, and they are conquering the United States by secret computer fraud, very cleverly set up with 12 major corporations who are the guilty. We have a website up, Jim, called openlettertodonaldtrump.com, and we made it an open letter to him back in September or so because we thought he might say something.
Do you know if he got it?
Well, it's on the internet, you know.
Yeah, I mean, know that, but, that's one thing.
I have indications. I sent him several overnights, including one on New Year's Eve down to Mar-a-Lago addressed to Melania, asking her to pass it on to him because it might get through to her. But I have indication that, yes, they're aware of this, but his lawyers or whoever, he is not. They've decided not to bring this up. All he's got to say is, in case somebody sends him this program, is, look, elections are too important to trust to secret computer counts. We need paper ballots counted in the open. We cannot leave these elections to
right.
or to.
Well, the whole idea of introducing these machines was because the Republicans looked forward and realized they'd never win another election if they were held openly and honestly.
I'm not as much in that camp. I know that is very much the Republicans are very much part of it, but. The
Subtle, the issues that matter to those who are controlling the machines are somewhat more complex than mere party differences.
In other words, they use both parties. I was on a thread of emails with every prominent professor and person that I quote, and a lot of people got on the same email thread. Okay. They were saying in 2005, because Hacking Democracy had just come out. Hacking Democracy is an HBO movie, and it's an excellent movie documentary featuring Bev Harris and her excellent work.
Yeah, right? Black box voting.
However, in that, the one thing that, in my opinion, that's off in that movie is they imply that the Bushes control the voting machines, okay? Now, there's no question about it that people like Mitt Romney are heavy investors in these voting machines. But that's far different from controlling them. I believe these things are controlled right at the top, at the secrets, not the secret, but the intelligence agencies, the dark side of the intelligence agencies for the international bankers.
Yeah.
And of course, so people don't get the wrong idea if they're new to this. These international banking factions, these powerful factions, or not only banking, but different factions that kind of or coalitions that, you know, more or less direct the world, right? They kill each other sometimes. There was a publisher from Great Britain, I think he was originally from Hungary, named Robert Maxwell back in 1991 or so, that got thrown over his yacht. His yacht looked more like the Titanic. It was so big. And they kill each other sometimes. But, yeah, but the point is there's coalitions.
They threw him off the yacht into the ocean?
Yes, well, or they claim he fell, but I mean, I don't know how.
That's awfully convenient, isn't it?
And I don't know how, as an old man, he could even climbed over the ledges, you know. But so they kill each other sometimes, and you know, Ron Brown was probably assassinated.
Sure, he had a bullet hole in his head. That's an unusual effect of a plane crash.
Right, exactly. So there's a plenty. The body count. We had a disc jockey, a talk show host here recently that ran through.
The Clintons have a whole string of deaths associated with them.
Yeah, and he read that, and I forgot what the body count of adults in the wake of the Clintons is tremendous. Now, that doesn't mean Hillary's going out and killing himself.
Of course not. Of course not.
But there is coalitions that include very brilliant strategists. Okay, in the other side, they include unlimited money virtually from the international banks who virtually have gotten from the world the kind of the nod to issue money. And then if you can issue money, you can issue a lot of money that can't be traced by, you know, just by running it through corporations and things. And then assassination squads, the dark sides of the intelligence agencies, like the CIA, which was only set up in 1947. It's only 6 years older than I am. It's not like it's something that God gave us at the beginning of time. This is an evil organization in large part to control the American people in the world. So they're part of this whole thing. So the point is that, what I'm getting here is that the computers, controlled by these factions, and I believe, you know, there's, maybe we can get into it after the top of the hour. I'd like to run through the 12 corporations that are part of the election night vote keepers.
Absolutely. Listen, we might have time to squeeze in your commercial before we have to go to the break.
Oh, okay. You want me to try to play that commercial?
Yeah, sure. Go right ahead, Jim.
All right. No, I'm going to find it here real quick. And I
then we'll talk a minute or two more. We'll go to the break, and then we'll start over.
Yeah. So we got open letter to DonaldTrump.com up. We also have, as a tab on there, Election Night Gatekeepers. And so Election Night Gatekeepers goes through exactly what happens on election night, okay? Now, I guess I'm going to have to, let's see, I'm having trouble. Can
find it. Can I always play it afterwards, so if
can I minimize the screen here or not? Oh, exit full screen. Okay, hold on. I got it. I'll have it in just a second.
Oh, you mean so you can see your desktop?
Yeah, I have to see my desktop to find this daggone commercial here.
So I should have you do it at the break. So
no, that's okay. We'll do it that quick. We can do it this quick. So here we go. Here we go. Ready? All right. Here we go. Let's try it. Okay. Here we go.
And now, let Freedom Ring 2016.com, the radio show, paid for by Jim Conda Jr. for Congress 2016.
That's what you'll hear this Sunday afternoon at 2 p.m. on 55 KRC. I promise you one thing, I'll be committing way too much free speech this Sunday. Here comes the computer election fraud against Trump. The press is floating that the despicable Goldman Sachs puppet, John Kasich, is going to win the Ohio primary. This is not going to happen without massive computer vote fraud perpetrated against Trump. Current easily rigged computer elections are illegal and a crime against the American people since 1988, and much more. Tune in.
That's 2 p.m. this Sunday on 55 KRC.
Paid for by Jim Conda Jr. for Congress.
That's sensational, Jim.
Now I want people to realize, because I'm begging other people across the country in their city to consider doing this, that when that's played from at drive time, and of course I can't, every commercial isn't a drive time, but we do get, you know, commercials. In this case, it was 2 days in a row over drive time. Okay. That's heard by 150 to 300,000 people on WLW, that commercial. I don't know what they think. I don't know if they think I'm crazy. I don't know if they're driving off the road. I don't know if they're saying, this is interesting. I know a few people called me and thanked me, because there are a lot of people aware of the computer vote fraud now, you know, after hacking.
That's good. That's good. That's good. We got to do more. We got to take a break. This is
okay.
Your host on The Real Deal with my very special guest tonight, Jim Conda Jr., will be right back.
Moonrock Books. We're a group of scholars, experts, and authors who feel the world really needs saving, and that resisting the American Empire is the right thing to do. People are starved for truth. They are given lies. They subsist on lies, but it's not really living. People are not watching TV news. They're ceasing to read newspapers, too, because they know by now they will not find it there. The biggest battle being fought anywhere is with information. If the people can receive the truth, they will do the right thing. We are publishing the truth about Sandy Hook, about the Boston bombing, about the moon landings, about the Holocaust, and much, much more. The truth. It falls upon us to fight the empire and save the world. Join us, Moonrock Books.
Hi, this is Gary King. Here's a song written when I was just 18. People have always enjoyed this song, and finally, 40 years later, I went ahead and recorded it. If you like it, download it on iTunes. It's called I'm Not in Love, I'm Just in Heat. Gary King. Go to iTunes and download it if you like it. Song for 40 years, played at party after party after party in the city of partying, New Orleans, Louisiana. If you dig it, go to iTunes and download it. I'm Not in Love, I'm Just in Heat, Gary King. And I also hope you enjoy the programming we provide here. And if you're into JFK, you can go to my YouTube channel, Gary King YouTube. And I do a weekly show with Jim Fetzer, Don Fox, and Larry Rivera. Hope to see you soon.
Live from the Media Broadcasting Center.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, continuing my conversation with Jim Condit Jr. Jim, I'm really enjoying this. This is such important information the American people have to understand. And they are so naive and gullible that they're taken in by what they're told by the media, which is completely under the control of the government and the intel agencies.
And we're going to see in a few minutes that five of the 12 corporations that are the election night gatekeepers are ABC, CBS, NBC, CNN, and Fox.
Disgusting.
So I just wanted to finish up two things and then
I want you to go ahead. Take your time.
We still got the, and we got this important slide up mentioning Wisconsin, which I believe you have something to finish.
Yeah. But I want you to tell us about Ohio and Kasich.
Yeah, I'm going to do that. But first, I wanted to say, I don't know. You may be right that the demographics and all this are such, or people's disgust with the continuous wars, that the Republicans would never win a presidential election again. I don't know for sure about that. But I will say this, the powers that be use the parties as Pat Buchanan called them, two wings on the same bird of prey. And the bird of prey, again, is to me the vulturous financial institutions at the top, not your local bank down the street where your neighbors work. Or I'm talking about the international banks in Switzerland, London, New York, D.C., based, you know, powered out of there. And they've been, you know, when you have unlimited money and you have sociopaths starting 100 years ago to run it. Sociopaths and unlimited money, virtually speaking, is a bad combination. And that's what I think we got running the world in large
part. I think that's right.
There's thousands of people, tens of thousands like you and me, that are trying to hold back the tide. And I think we've been quite successful in many ways, but they're still advancing, you know. So I'm not pessimistic in the long run. But how much suffering is going to have to happen till we, till the good guys, you might say, you know, tilt the balance? But I believe we could be tilting the balance this year if we were getting on honest counts. You know, if
yes, they were, yes, yes, yes.
If they were honest counts,
they had to steal Texas, steal Ohio. They had to Trump. They had to tramp Trump down.
Yeah, exactly. Now, I just want to make that point that I think. The old follow the money thing, you know, that's a big, everybody say follow the money if it's some petty crime in Chicago. How about let's following the money at the top of the world? And that who logically has now bought the media, the big media, has erected all three of these companies that run 96% of our vote, Jim. Only three corporations, private companies, are counting, quote-unquote, 96% of our vote, okay?
Isn't that insane, Jim?
It's insane. Except
every poll worker who's counting paper ballots with two observers from each party that's doing the work. We didn't need the goddamn machines, and they're stealing democracy from us right under our nose.
Now, one of the things I need to reprove in the current decade is that when you go and look at what these – now, it's so funny I say, well – and let me name the three companies since we've named – there are three.
Yeah.
There is ES&S, Election System and Software, out of Omaha, Nebraska. Don't worry about what city is out of. They move company names all the time.
Sure.
But Election System and Software has been around since the 90s. Just give people an idea how this works. Before that, they were business record corporations out of Texas. Before that, they were computer election services back in California in the 70s. But don't be fooled by the moving from countries, state to state, or name to name. Same people, same group, more or less. Okay, so they count, according to Nation Magazine, Ronnie Duggar. I don't know if Ronnie Duggar is still alive or not, but he was the guy that back in the 60s, as 1960, asked the question to the Protestant minister that ended up in John Kennedy going to speak to the Protestant ministers. If you remember that incident back in the 1960 campaign, Duggar asked the question that led to that. But he wrote an article in 1988 for the New Yorker, The Dangers of Computerized Elections. That was the first major publication to do an establishment publication to do an excellent article.
That's when the New Yorker was worth reading.
And now he did in 2004, How They Could Steal the Election This Time, for the Nation. And we got that linked on openlettertodonaldtrump.com, or you can go straight to the Nation. Now, he says in that article that at that time, 60% of the American vote on election night, primaries in the spring and November election, is counted by this one company, Election System and Software. 36% more, now we're up to 96%, was counted by three other companies, Sequoia, Hart Civic, and Diebold. Now, Diebold got a real stinky name in 2004 for saying, we're going to make sure George W. Bush gets reelected. You probably remember that.
Everybody. Yes, I do.
So they got such a stinky name that in 2013, a company called Dominion bought Sequoia and Diebold. So now instead of there being four companies counting 96% of the American vote, there's three companies, ES&S, Hart, which we use in Cincinnati. ESS is used up in the 8th District where I'm running for Congress.
You know what's so absurd about this is that the software for accounting is so elementary. You're taking a number N and adding one to it to produce a new number N plus one.
Well,
any company that claims their software is proprietary is clearly engaged in fraud. There's no other reason for it.
Of course. And in fact, the Collyers make tremendous fun of this in VoteScam. Jim Carrey used to say, what's the big deal? It's one for you, one for me, one for you, one for me. I mean, that's all there is to vote counting. The reason I say that the current election, computerized election system is made by crooks for crooks. Okay. And so the only reason you want to take the vote in the back room and count it in secret is that you want to cheat.
Yes.
Normal people, like, let's say we were running a grade school election. Normal people like you and me wouldn't say, okay, now we're going to take the votes in the back room and count them, you know, and then you come out and you tell everybody present, whether it be adults or kids, I won. My candidate won. And they say, well, we'd like to see the ballots. And you say, well, wait a minute. I'll go back and count it again. And, and then you come out and say, I still won. This is the system we have.
I love it.
The ballots disappear. Okay. So now again, there's these three companies. Well, somebody might say to me, well, listen, Condit, what did they do? Did they break in and take over the system? No. What happened was, is they have been hired, believe it or not, by, like 3,000 out of, we had 3,000, we had 50 states, of course, in the United States, 3,141 counties, and about 3,000 of these counties have hired one of these three big companies, or in some of the smaller counties, one of the smaller companies that I believe are their satellites.
Yeah, so Jim, is this all self-conscious, knowing they're deliberately setting up an elaborate scam, or are these?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. I think the county officials are basically brain dead. They are committing crimes. There's two Supreme Court decisions that forbid secret counts, and we have them up on openletterdonaldtrump.com. Okay, there are two Supreme Courts, and a third one, which I think was called, I think it was Westbury versus Sanders in 1964, tied in with the Civil Rights Act, said, if your right to vote is spoiled or vitiated, then all other rights are illusory.
Yes.
That isn't the truth.
So
what we got going here is, no, they didn't break in. They came, and this gets back to the RNC and the DNC, two of the other companies that are in on the election night gatekeepers. They're actually not companies, but they may as well be. They have told all their secretary of states, all their counties. Now, listen, here's some companies. They're really efficient. They'll take all the headaches out of it for you. They'll do the counting. You just sign the results. And these brain dead, in some cases, I'm sure they're corrupt, but I think they're mainly just brain dead. County officials and county commissioners sign these contracts with these three big companies now, and they let them, they turn the system over to them. And they turn over the computers, and the software is, quote, proprietary. There's been dozens of cases in the last, since 1980s, trying to look at this software. And the judges have always stood up for the company. That no, you can't look at it. It's proprietary. So
are the judges out of their minds? I mean, are they complicit? Are they bought? I mean, this is stupid beyond belief.
The judges have to be bought. That doesn't mean that they know when they start hearing the case, but they must be talked to, threatened. Every judge has upheld the proprietary nature of one and one or two.
There cannot be anything proprietary if it's honest. There's
of course
nothing
not.
To it. I mean, this is so cut and dried. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, and every one of the millennials and young people know this. But I was 26 years old when they put this in Cincinnati.
You didn't grow up with a computer in your hand.
Yeah, I was 20 to 26, but I could tell, I knew then it was wrong. There was a guy named Mike Gingrich at the Cincinnati Board of Elections, who I never met, who other people told me that he was telling people I was the only one in Cincinnati who was sounding the alarm. And he was talking to a guy named Gordon Shearer, who had been a congressman and was a conservative congressman on the way to the meeting where this was going to be approved. And Mike Gingrich was saying, Mr. Scheer, we can't put this in. This is open to manipulation. And Scheer, who was mesmerized, you know, he was like 70 or 80 then. He was mesmerized by the computers and thought it was magic, I guess. He said, well, you can testify, but it's going in. So the deal had already been made. But what I want to say about this is, so I have, just to emphasize the point here, okay, I have the Secretary of State of Ohio on tape, and it's about to go up on a YouTube, but I don't have it done yet, unfortunately, because it's taking a little editing, because I want to get his words up there so people can read him as he's talking, and a few other things. But at a September 17th, 2012 Tea Party meeting in Cincinnati at the wedding reception hall called The Farm, I went over and asked a question, and the owner was audiotaping the whole thing, and he gave me a copy of it. I asked John Husted, the Secretary of State of Ohio, was the guest speaker, okay, about a month and a half before the Romney Obama election. And so I asked him, basically, I'll truncate it down. Since we're using the secret software of private companies in all 88 counties of Ohio, and all the rest of the counties in the United States, except half of New Hampshire, since we're using secret computer programs of private companies, and since you and the 88 election officials in the counties in Ohio sign a contract that you're not allowed to look at the software, thereby making it secret counts, aren't we running illegal elections according to the three Supreme Court decisions that I
mentioned? Excellent, excellent, excellent.
Now, he admitted that they were doing this. He said, well, he said, all I can tell, he did not say, oh no, we don't sign a contract. Now it's in the contract, but we don't sign a contract that we can't. He said, well, it is a problem. He said, I'm not quoting verbatim, but we'll put it up so people can hear the exact exchange. He said, it is a problem. He said, but if we got sued over this, then here's how we would defend ourselves.
It's not a problem. It's a constitutional abomination.
And a nationwide crisis.
Calling it a problem is just trivializing the absurdity of the situation.
Well, true. Although I was grateful he at least admitted by his answer that this was true, that they could not look at the software, because he could have ridiculed me and lied and, you know, had me sit down or whatever. But he did it by his answer confirm. And he said, if we were sued, we would say that we were following the HAVA Act, which Chuck Schumer and a few other senators wrote in 2002, we would say this, we would say that. And of course, I'm sure they are doing all the things he said, but they're all totally beside the point. The only thing that's on point is get rid of all the computers. Even though I love computers, we all love computers. We're using computers to broadcast now and end run the media. But when it comes to elections, Adam Osborne, who built one of the first one of the first home computers, Adam Osborne, in the book Running Wild in 1979, said, computers are great, but there are several things they should never be used for, and one of them is elections, because
Yes. Nobody
can see for sure what's happening. It's a secret count. The state law in New Hampshire and South Carolina forbids secret counts. The Constitution, by implication, by saying that, you know, by account of the voters, by the will of the voters, forbids secret counts.
But they're still using computers, right?
Yes, and they're still using secret counts. These are secret counts. So,
no, but what I mean is, even though their state law forbids it, they're still doing it.
Oh, absolutely. In South Carolina, there were no ballots. They just go in, there's a bleep of energy.
How ridiculous. How did Trump pull out South Carolina under those?
Well, this is the thing that is another aspect of this. When you're getting 20, 30,000 people, when all over the state are Trump signs and Trump bumper stickers, it's got to be believable. It's got to be believable. And that's why I think they had to give him some of these things.
So this is why I'm troubled about the New York primary. Bernie was pulling the big crowds, not Hillary.
Oh, but if we had this is my opinion, because that's the whole problem is we can't see the ballots for sure. That's why some of my posts that I've done on openlettertodonaldtrump.com say, let's see the ballots, Ohio. Let's see the ballots, Wisconsin. That's the key thing. Nobody sees any ballots on election day.
Right.
In Ohio, we go ahead and we vote. We put it in an ATM-type machine, and then they slap you in the face the final time when the the picture comes up on the little machine with an American flag and says, your vote has been counted. But so it goes off into Never Never Land, and they run them through the computers at the county headquarters in Ohio.
Jim, it seems to me they're unconstitutional on the face, because if someone wants a recount, they can't get one. I mean, how can a candidate who believes they've been cheated get a recount if there aren't even any ballots?
Exactly. Now, that's in Ohio we have ballots. In Wisconsin, you probably have ballots. But in South Carolina,
we have ballots, too, and optical scanners.
Yeah. And so in South Carolina and in Georgia, this is totally illegal on that front alone. You don't have any way to do a recount. It could not be more absurd. We have a YouTube up. It's linked on openlettertodonaldtrump.com called, it was put up in 2008, called South Carolina Super Tuesday and Ron Paul. And in 10 minutes there, I go through the a bunch of stuff, including the Supreme Court decisions and the absurdity of what was happening in South Carolina, which was uncovered by an attorney named Mark Adams in Florida. And we lead off the 10-minute YouTube with him. But so anyway, what should be happening, and you've already alluded to it, and what was happening in the 1960s going back to 1776, or whenever they, I guess 1787, is you have paper ballots have cast in your neighborhood precinct, put in a box that now should be a clear plastic box, the Collier's always said, but even if it's a cardboard box, people anytime during the day can check that there's no false bottom, and all the ballots are put in there, dumped out at 7 o'clock at night or 7:30, whenever the polls goes, and they're counted in the open with everyone allowed to stand around and see it without interfering, of course. The Democrats, the Republicans, independents, the neighbors can all stand around and have a look at what's happening. And then you post the results on the wall, and then they send them down to the county, where with a calculator they could add up all the precincts. And as long as the citizens and the candidates and the parties are monitoring that at each level, then to make sure everybody is, you know, adds them up on us, that is as close as you can get to an election. And that's what should be happening. It would cost us, we have this on linked also on that same website, it would cost us about, I believe it's $480 million a year to run
the whole country.
To pay 12 people, yes, to pay 12 people at each of the precincts. That would turn out to be about 3,600,000 people. But that's how many judges we got working at the polls on election day when you're helping people to register in that. So, you have
small price for liberty.
Small price, even if it was 10 times that much, we could cut it. We spent $48 billion in the first 12 months in Iraq.
How did Mitt Romney not become elected? There was just too much enthusiasm for Obama?
No, you're asking me my opinion on that. I believe that I believe Romney was probably elected, and I'll go into that.
Oh, so the poll, the manipulation was to benefit Obama.
Yeah, the powers that be wanted Obama 4 more years.
Yeah, ago, probably because of his history and the way he was raised, and
well, and also
he was a creature of the CIA.
And he was also making good progress on certain things, and then if they put in a Republican, they'll hope they make good progress on other things. What I've said at the minimum on the Trump situation, though, is the Trump ego has run into the Goldman Sachs ego. In other words, the ruling elite does not trust Trump. I don't know if anybody who's, you know, isn't new to politics really trusts Trump. I don't know if I don't know what he's going to do if he becomes president.
But he's a hell of a lot better than anyone else.
Yeah, I just feel that he is talking from the heart. He wants to be a great president. He's going to run into all kinds of static. But I don't even know for sure on any of these. But they certainly don't trust him. So that is the minimum that's happening with Trump.
Yeah, well, they're trying to stop him every possible way they can.
Yeah, he's being beat down on the three cable networks, the 24-hour cable networks.
Well, I'll tell you, we had a breakthrough because Fox just converted the other day on Hannity. They had Laura Ingraham on, and they also had Rudy Giuliani, and they were both saying they thought that Trump, if he had the most votes, should be the president. Hannity was agreeing with him.
Yeah, there is a certain faction. I think Hannity might have his eye on a communications director in the Trump White House, but yeah, no, they've been doing good on that show. And the point is that even the establishment is now coming to grips that they're not going to be able to make it believable, because Cruz is a very unlikable guy.
Casey, oh, he's disgusting. He's a sex pervert. You understand that?
I've heard that. I've heard
Wayne,
that.
And Wayne Madsen, one of our best investigative journalists, discovered that when he was at Princeton, and when I was at Princeton years before it was all men, but they had admitted women, he would dress in women's clothes to go to sororities to watch the girls going back and forth to the showers.
Good grief.
And of course, you have to know the Inquirer was right in saying he'd had affairs with these five women. A reporter by the name of Drew Johnson for the Washington Times was fired when he confirmed that two of them were correct.
I heard that, yeah.
You have to report that that his Senate office was subscribing to the Ashley Madison Adultery Magazine, and the D.C. Madam's attorney wants to release her records, which show that that Cruz was one of her clients.
Yeah, there was an obvious murder, the D.C. Madam, yeah.
Yeah, it was. But who's blocking the release is Clarence Thomas, and I'm sure his name is in that little black book, too.
Now, I knew that the other Supreme Court justice had blocked it, and the guy went to Thomas. Did he block
Roberts.
It?
Yeah, Roberts blocked it. I gather Thomas blocked it.
Wait. Did Thomas block it, too, already? I hadn't heard that. Has he already blocked it?
Well, this is my impression. I could be mistaken, but the fact is we already know. I was on with Jeff Renz a couple of weeks ago talking about it, and he said we already know, and he sent me copies of the record showing it was indeed Cruz.
Okay. So, and then you got Kasich is a nothing. So it's going to be hard to believe when Trump...
Well, the thing about Cruz in relation to these sex matters, I mean, if Donald had some dalliances, who would care? I mean, he's had a flamboyant life. Nobody would care. Bernie's obviously not fooling around. Hillary has a bizarre and perverted sex life all by itself with her husband, Bill.
Yeah. You
know, that is convoluted as can be. But you got this guy, Ted Cruz, who claims to be a personification of moral virtue and a representative of evangelical Christianity.
Yeah, right. And so, again, at this juncture, with Trump still getting the 20 and 30,000 crowds, and often these guys can't get 100 people, and it's kind of a lot more there people, and there's no enthusiasm.
Yeah. So,
to say, imagine in July, if they, you know, somehow Cruz or Kasich walks up on the stage, half the country is going to know right now that it's fixed right at that point. Now, Trump has done a tremendous service. I've been wanting somebody to do this for 20 or 30 years. When he says, this delegate process is rigged.
Yes.
He's not telling the half of it. I mean, these delegate processes in both parties, but certainly in the Republican Party that I have experience in, they are totally rigged. I mean, what you do is you go to the meeting, but the party bosses have one rule. We win and you lose. I could go into depth in what we ran into in 1990 all the way up to the Ohio Supreme Court. And these people that are running these parties, and I have experience in the Republican Party, they act like they have divine right of kings to run it for the rest of their life.
Yes.
There's actually, and that's when they say, oh, Trump, the establishment is going to have to make peace with Trump. There would be no establishment if we had honest elections. They would have been thrown out on their ear back in 2004 or something like that, you know?
Yes.
So this is how important this vote thing is. So again, what should happen, maybe you can tie some things together here, and then you got to, I want to mention Ohio and Wisconsin.
Keep going, Jim. You're doing great. I'm going to
tie two things together here because we've kind of touched on it, and then we'll go into Ohio and Wisconsin. What should happen at every precinct, okay? And I have full legislation thought out on this, and if you had state bodies in the Congress that wanted honest elections, we could have them. Because now, Jim, we could build about 60,000 election buildings that served about five precincts each. Okay. There might have to be a few out in the country more that add on to that a little bit when they're too rural. But you have election buildings that could be used as first come, first serve organizing for, you know, groups, civic groups to come and give speeches or sewing groups or whatever, you know, people that want diet groups trying to teach people how to eat. They could be used for that the rest of the year, but on election night, they would be tailored for the election. And where the scrutineers, which is what we used to call the ballot counters, there would be 12 in each precinct, pre-selected randomly, maybe out of a hat, from the voters in the precinct, okay? So you'd say, okay, anybody that wants to do this and get paid $100 for 4 hours work on election night. You come, we'll pick 8 counters. That's the average precinct. It would vary depending on the population. But usually about 200 people vote in many of these precincts. So you have 8 people be the counters and 4 backups in case somebody gets sick. Jim Collier used to always say one of those 8 positions would be reserved for a high school senior or a college student. In other words, one of those positions would be only high school seniors and college students, if any, so that the younger generation could see how this worked and make sure they weren't snookered again out of our vote, you know. And then on election night, when it's closing time, the ballot box can never leave the sight of the judges. That was always the case. Everybody knew if somebody wanted to carry the ballot box out, they were up to no good. So it's got to stay in the public sight. Then you dump them out and count them. And it'd take about 4 hours probably if you, you know, did it, maybe did it again. And then you got your count, the 8 citizens that sign that. They sign an affidavit. This is our count for our 50. You got 4 of those signed by 2 people each. The judges sign it, Democrat, Republican, and Libertarians or Constitution, if any of those parties are recognized as, have qualified as parties in the state. Then you got to post it on the wall for 3 days. This could be done now, but I'm just saying it would be better if we had election buildings, because you could have then on the ceiling a camera going down onto the where they place the ballot as they're counting it, streamed over the internet or streamed on the put on a big screen in that room, so people can actually watch the count everywhere, what they were doing by the camera that's coming from the ceiling down on the ballot they're counting. So if we wanted to have honest elections, we could. This would cost, for 60 years of paying 3 million plus citizens to fit $100 each to count for 4 hours work, to count the ballots, and the primary and the November election, which cost $48 billion approximately, which is what we spent in the first 12 months in Iraq in 2003, 2004. So it's not really expensive, like you said, when freedom and democracy and our republic is at stake. So that's what should happen. What is happening to tie that up is you got 12 corporations that are election night gatekeepers, and you can go to openlettertodonaldtrump.com. And on election night gatekeepers, there's a 73-minute audio. Sorry if it's so long, but I had to cover everything. And then there's an essay. And the 12 corporations are, you know, the RNC, the Republican National Committee, and the Democratic National Committee. They're the ones that have recommended to all their Secretary of States, because the Democrats and Republicans control every county in the United States, and they've recommended to all their counties, oh no, great, hire these 3 big mega Buck, Rockefeller, Rothschild, you know, Goldman Sachs companies, because they're the only ones that have had the money to erect companies that are this gigantic and are ready to serve everybody. So hire one of them. And so they get the recommendation from the RNC and the DNC. Then you have the 3 private companies now, ESNS, Dominion, and Hart, okay, that are counting 96% of our vote approximately.
Is Hart H-E-A-R-T?
No, just H-A-R-T.
Okay.
Hart InterCivic is what it's called out of Texas, okay? And which is neither here nor there, but their head office is in
Texas. Yeah, I just want to know.
No, that's fine. No, the spelling is here nor there. I just meant I mentioned Texas. They could be in
yeah,
in,
sure, I got it.
Yep. Yeah, Venezuela or Thailand. It wouldn't matter with computers. So at any rate, and then those 3 companies, now we got 5, okay? The RNC, the DNC, and those 3 companies. Now we have the next ones that are in the next corporation that's in on this is National Election Pool. And that used to be Voter News Service. And they do all the exit polls, and they are the in-between or the conduit or the go-between between the 3 major companies that are counting the votes, quote unquote, and the 5 TV networks. Okay. National Election Pool. That's 6. Now, guess who owns National Election Pool? Guess who? It's ABC, CBS, NBC, CNN, and Fox. That's right on Wikipedia. It's right on their website, the National Election Pool website. So there's the next 5 corporations to make the 11. And then AP, which is where all the big city dailies and all the radio stations get their election news, they are also an owner of National Election Pool, this company.
It's a self-contained system.
And that's why, Mr. and Mrs. America, you've never heard of any of this, because the major networks are blocking you from
knowing.
They're
complicit in it.
They're up to their necks. And I say that the heads of the networks should be arrested for treason, because they're enabling the stealing of these elections. Now, again, there's no reason to despair or go up on a cliff and get ready to jump off. Each of the counties have the power to throw out all the computers, all the machines, and reinstitute the hand counting. So this could be done overnight if we could get some public officials with backbone, or if the public became enraged. So while Trump should be objecting, the one thing he has not done, and this is, we couldn't get Ron Paul to do it. Buchanan was early, but I don't think they listened to us, but they didn't quite believe it or something. They never brought it up. Pat brought it up anemically after the 2000 election, and in 2004, he brought it up on a broadcast about these secret computer accounts. Ron Paul kind of got close to it once, but this should be a main issue of every campaign. It's not sour grapes. It's getting a fair count for
right.
your voters.
A fair shake. The American people, Jim.
Exactly. If I'm going to ask you to go out and walk neighborhoods and donate money to me, I have a responsibility as a candidate to do everything I can to ensure that you, the voter, get a fair count.
Are vast sums of money involved here.
Absolutely.
People are being deluded. They're being conned. They're making contributions or sacrificing their money to support parties and candidates, and they're being scammed.
Right. So even Trump, this is so far the one thing he hasn't brought up. It's a big mistake, especially if he gets in against him and Hillary. They're going to, you know, he's wide open to massive fraud. But at any rate, but what Trump has done now, and this is another reason I don't think they can take it from him too easily. He has said in every speech recently, the whole system is rigged. The delegate system is rigged. And that now has with everything. Well, first of all, Trump is funny. And he's a more charismatic speaker compared to the others.
Yeah.
And he's won millions more votes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, if he loses in Cleveland, already half the country is going to think it's rigged because they know that people instinctively know if they think about it.
Look what you were saying about Texas. Everyone was talking about Trump.
Absolutely.
Nobody gave a damn about Cruz, and yet Cruz wins.
Now let's tie up Ohio and Wisconsin on the heels of that, what you just said. So one other thing I wanted to say about Ohio, besides these incredible crowds for Trump and the anemic non-crowds for Kasich in his own home state where he's supposedly popular, everyone in Ohio knows he is not popular in Ohio. They ran nobody against him. They ran a Democrat that did not campaign, was a no name. In other words, the boys that are more powerful than the two parties that use them made sure Kasich had a clear path, okay? And probably they were even looking ahead towards this.
Rex Priebus has implied that out of Cleveland will come one of the candidates who's running now, and he's not talking about Ted Cruz or Donald Trump.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
They have pre-designated Kasich to be the presidential nominee of the Republican Party.
That'll be disgusting. Yeah, and I was just going to say, people that are hearing this for the first time, now that you know that our elections are easily rigged and counted in secret by three private companies with the permission of your local election officials, and they agree not to be able to see the program, which is so stupid, Jim, you can't hardly make it. If this was as a script to a movie,
it's totally moronic, Jim.
Yeah, and the people would say, you can't make a movie out of this. The plot's too unbelievable that the election officials would sign away their right to look at the election software. So, but with this said, now that people are hearing this, now I can say, and I think many people at least consider it seriously, Dole didn't win in 1996. Buchanan was a much better candidate. That was computer fraud. McCain didn't win in 2008. He had no support whatsoever until they said he won New Hampshire, and then he won Super Tuesday. And Romney didn't win the nomination in 2012. The reason I said before that maybe Romney won is because him and Obama were neck and neck, and a lot of computers, according to Bev Harris, a lot of computers in the big cities went down. And if any,
went
and then,
down. Isn't that amazing? They went down.
And then when they came back up, Obama was doing well, and I could tell you a bunch more stories like that. Megyn Kelly on Fox, if anybody was watching Fox may remember, she said Karl Rove was on scene, this thing, and I don't want to be joined at the hip with Karl Rove, because to me he's one of the biggest crooks, but he must have been told that his guy was going to win, and he said to Megyn when they projected Ohio for Obama, he said, this is impossible, this is wrong. So Megyn Kelly took off her mic and had a lapel mic and walked out and said, I'm going back to get the statisticians to come out here and debate you on the stage, because she found this interesting that Rove was disagreeing.
Yeah.
Well, it ended up, then it got worse and they didn't do the debate.
She's got a lot of integrity. You know, she's got a law degree as well as three kids.
Yeah, yeah. And that was unprecedented for either Rove to challenge it or for Megan to go back and say, I'm going to bring the statisticians out here. Now, so I think Romney probably won that, but yeah, how do we know for sure unless we see the vote? Now, finishing up Ohio, besides all this other stuff, we had the biggest turnout ever, okay, in Ohio for Republican.
Yeah.
And here's what the Youngstown Republican Party talked about locally, and it hit the national news, because even the big guys controlling the media, they don't control everything. So it gets to the national news. The Youngstown Republican Party said that for months we've had Democrats calling our Republican headquarters saying, how can they change from Democrat to Republican to vote for Trump? Okay, now, if that's happening in Youngstown, that's a good poll. That's happening all over the state. Or is somebody going to try to tell me that we got the largest turnout ever in Ohio because of Kasich?
Trump did it.
And then
all boring and incompetent.
Yeah, yeah. And there's some people were trying to say, well, Democrats crossed to vote against Trump. Well, that may have happened in a few cases. The media found one family in Ohio that said they had a family meeting and they voted, changed the Republican to vote for Trump, which doesn't make any sense on a mass scale because Bernie had just upset Hillary in Michigan.
Yeah.
And whether you were for Hillary or Bernie, you wanted to vote for your person, you know, in the state. So, you know, again, we could go into each one of these cases. Why did Trump win here? Why did Kasich win? Sanders win there. I'll just say this and then you tie up Wisconsin because I've been filibustering you on that.
No. I love what you're saying.
If we had an honest election, I'm not a socialist. I believe Bernie is pinpointing a lot of the problems. I'm a social creditor. I don't know if you've heard of the social credit movement, Jim, but I believe that is the answer.
Jim, you know, the most popular programs in American history, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, unemployment insurance, workman's compensation, they are all socialistic programs.
The social credit is actually a limited free enterprise program, but it's where you have a sheriff. You let people's talents and, you know.
I don't think anyone cares anymore that he has been characterized as a socialist. People love Bernie. He's wonderful.
What I was going to say was to cut to the chase here, and then I want to hear what you're going to say about Wisconsin. If we had an honest vote count, Hillary would have been out of the race. She would have been landslided long ago, and Trump would have been winning these elections 70-80%, splitting 20. And that isn't necessarily a great compliment to Trump or to the American people, but people are enamored with Trump because he's a celebrity. He's a billionaire. He says he's going to fight for the country and like he did for his own companies. And he's
opposing the trade policies that have gutted the manufacturing and industrial base of the United States. He's opposed to the wars that have cost us our treasury, $4 to $5 trillion, and thousands of good young men. And he supports the Second Amendment. He and Bernie are on the same side on all three of those issues. But Bernie is being clobbered. He's having his vote stolen from under him. And Hillary is being given it on a silver platter.
Vicious vote fraud. I would like to see any large body physically of black people, and I want to see them stand up and say, we like Hillary over Bernie. I don't believe this propaganda they're putting out that the black community overwhelmingly for Hillary.
I'm worried that they're very unsophisticated and have been taken advantage of. The Clintons are really disgusting people, the deeper you go.
Now, the reason that people are so much here's what's happened and this is why the Republicans, the average person can smell that the Republicans are no good. They are with the Wall Street vultures.
The Republicans in general, like Trump being the exception.
Yeah, right. Buchanan used the term in 1996 when he was running for president, vulture capitalism.
Yes.
And Charles Krauthammer the next day in his column jumped all over him. But that is true. We have vulture capitalism. Believe it or not, Pope Pius XI talked about this in 1931 in an encyclical. He said, when you get, he didn't, he didn't use the term vulture capitalism, but monopoly capitalism. When you get too few people owning too much of the goods, and he's talking especially then about South American countries, and the people are so poor, they're ready for socialism, but he said that they will listen to the socialists. Now, the middle road, in my opinion, which is another subject, is historically called social credit. We call it American national credit, but it would not be socialism, could not be centralized planning, but it would issue money properly. Because right now the Fed has us in a cash famine. We have all the goods we want. I mean, if you don't have food or housing, or if you don't have, you don't have any physical goods, you're poor. Maybe you're in dangerous starving death. When you have all of this and factories are lying idle by the tens of thousands and inventions and robots are coming, and what do we have lack of, Jim? We have lack of cash. Now, let me just address that real quickly, and then I got to let you do Wisconsin.
No, no, no. Everyone's heard me on Wisconsin.
Well, I want to hear it. But when you're talking money, okay, and I fell for this in the 70s. I got involved through, I was an alternate delegate to the Nixon convention, and I got involved with a number of the gold bugs in the right wing. I was listening to them, let's say, or reading their books, and a little uneasy, but I thought, well, I guess this makes sense. And they would always say, when you print money and you have more money chasing the same amount of goods, you get inflation, right? So like if you're in a auction hall and everybody's bidding on a car and everybody has $3,000, then nobody can bid over $3,000. Somebody hands everybody $10,000. Now the bids go above $3,000. So if you have the same amount of goods and you print money, yes, that's inflationary. But the major flaw in our modern world is we're not dealing with a static amount of goods. In fact, goods are being held back because the common person doesn't have cash in their pocket. So the Fed and the IMF and so forth have imposed on us in the world a cash famine, not a food famine, thank God, but a cash famine. And if money was issued properly, and I don't think hardly anybody understands this, Jim, if money was issued properly, as it should be from an honest replacement for the Fed, then the money would, what social credit or American national credit says, right now, every man and woman over 25 years old, we'd have $1,600 a month every month. And that would issue into circulation the right amount of money to equal the goods and services. The economy would spring forward again. What people can't come to grips with on the right, which I'm basically on, all my fellow conservatives, we're so rich, we can either let the bankers continue to issue money like they did since 1696. And if they had handled it right, Jim, they would be some of the greatest heroes. If the bankers had served the people, they could still all be billionaires. But they didn't serve the people. They're still exploiting the people. Or you can issue money interest-free to all the people because all of us, let me say this. If you have a rich uncle and he leaves you, one day you find out when you're 25 years old, gee, he left you enough money that you're going to get $1,600 for the rest of your life every month. Well, thank God for my uncle. Is that free money? Kind of. Okay. It is free money to you. He earned it, but it was free money to you. But our rich uncle, Jim, is Thomas Edison and Nikola Tesla and Henry Ford and Steve Jobs and all the millions of people that invented the microphone I'm talking on and the chair that I'm sitting on that is well crafted. All those millions of innovations, we all as human beings inherit that patrimony or that heritage. And that's why C.H. Douglas, who thought up the social credit system in 1970, he saw this coming. He said, someday we're not going to need the whole workforce. Okay. And what are we going to do then? Let two thirds of the people sit around on the corner begging with a tin cup for money? No, we've got to face the new reality of superabundance, which my fellow conservatives have trouble wrapping their head around, and issue money to equal that superabundance so that the cash in circulation about equals the goods and services that we can produce. So I'm sorry to go off on that, but all these things.
No. I think it's fantastic.
All these things are at stake. And many socialists, by the way, in the 30s converted from socialism to social credit because it took away the element of a small group having to try to centrally control everything. And it was a way to end run the bankers and issue money interest free to the country. Now, if things went the other direction, you'd have to withdraw money from circulation, but you would scientifically monitor the goods and services versus the cash in circulation. And scientifically, you would issue the money as close as you can get. Now, please tell us about Wisconsin. What was the other factor on Wisconsin you were going to tell us that indicated?
Well, I'm still thinking about, it's not so much that they don't like Bernie. It's not even that he's a socialist. It's that they want Hillary because she's totally controlled.
Absolutely.
She's totally in the web of the bad guys. And they want a reliable bad guy at the top rung of the ladder. Bernie, everybody loves Bernie. He's fascinating. It's Don Quixote, but he's winning. You know, it's fascinating.
Yeah, and you know, the people in their gut, and this is why I trusted Buchanan and Ron Paul and Trump, and I feel the same way. I'm not sure, again, what all would happen if Bernie got in, but people, the reason he's getting 10,000, 30,000 people at his rallies is that they instinctively feel if this guy could break free from the upper echelon financial people, he would probably give the people a fair shake. And they feel that about Trump, too. And they don't feel it about Dole, McCain, Romney. I mean, I'm falling asleep saying their names. People,
those are scumbags. They're self-centered. They're selfish. They have not a degree of altruism in their whole body.
Yeah, they're not going to do it.
Both Bernie and Trump can transcend their ego. They care about other people.
And people can sense that these other guys we were talking about and Hillary are not going to do anything for them. They can sense it. When they get in, it's business as usual.
Yeah.
And the business as usual is turning the whole world into serfs for no reason whatsoever. We live in an age of plenty. We live in the most plentiful age of physical goods in the history of mankind. We live in the age that the past generations before 1900 dreamed of.
Jim, I agree 100%. You're absolutely right. Why they want to, you know, eradicate a vast percentage of the world's population and have a feudal society is beyond me. It's insane.
One of my daughters, I have six kids, and the youngest daughter, all my daughters are sweet, but she's kind of the shyest and the most sweet in a way. Not the most sweet, but she's a very sweet kid. And she said when she was 18 or 19, she's 26 now, but she said, "Dad, who would do all this?" when she heard me talking to somebody about this. "Dad, who would do all this?" I said, "Good question, Kate." Because when people are billionaires, why certain people in the world seem to want to dominate and mess with the lives of others instead of help everybody do as good as they can? I can't answer that, you know?
You know, I had a conversation with Paul Craig Roberts years ago about how these corporations seeking to maximize profits by getting lower wages workers in Mexico and all that through these trade treaties were essentially putting themselves out of business, because by eliminating the middle class, you no longer had a chunk of society with enough discretionary income that they could buy the high value products they're producing, the cars, the stereos, the TVs, the whole bit. I mean, And he said, you know, he says, "I've been going to boards of directors and trying to convince them of this for years, but they're absolutely fixated on short-term profit maximization."
Yeah, I think that's the case. And I think at the very top, a faction of it has a will to power domination agenda that to them is now more important than short-term money, because they got all the money they need.
Oh, it's social Darwinism. They think they're superior because they're rich. It's truly disgusting.
And they also look at a whole faction for different reasons. Look at the average person is not as fully human as they are, so they can go ahead and cause deaths, whatever.
Yes.
I mean, it is a very evil mindset. And but at any rate, that's one reason why elections are so important. And these rats we see dominating the political landscape, I believe in 2 to 4 years would be swept away with honest counts. Because as soon as you had one or two people at the local level win, everyone would have faith again that somebody could win who was a man or a woman of the people.
Yeah.
Well, right now, people have a deep, deep subconscious demoralization that we're always going to lose. And I contend that's because thousands and thousands of people who have a voice, I'm not talking about on the internet, but people that are in office who know about this will not demand an open count, because they sense that with the powers that be as they are in the Democrat and Republican Party, that's the end of your career if you bring this issue up.
That's right. That's right.
I mean, at some point, I think we're going to overpower them. I have faith in the long run.
Well, I think, I think Wisconsin was key because there would then be this long delay before New York, and they thought they could take the wind out of Trump's sails. They flipped it by 20 points. We had a Marquette school poll within a week. You know about a lot of this, of course, already, that showed that Trump was trailing Cruz by 10 points when, in fact, he'd been leading Cruz by at least 10 ever since they began polling.
Yeah,
so that was completely incredible. I got a hold of a brilliant statistician you may know, Richard Charnin, who's published two books about vote fraud.
Yeah.
Charnin and I had looked into it when Walker beat Mary Burke, who was a very good Democratic candidate. They brought in Michelle Obama twice, Barack once, the big dog Bill Clinton. We had an historic turnout. There was great enthusiasm on the Democratic side. And would you believe when he looked into the Marquette, the Milwaukee County, which is a bastion of Democratic support, he found that the greater the number of votes cast, the greater the percentage that went to Walker, the Republican candidate, which was absurd.
Uh-huh.
In fact, Garnon has discovered five different elections in Wisconsin were rigged, including Scott Walker's recall election, including a Supreme Court election of a guy named Prosser against a more qualified woman named Kloppenberg. Scott Walker's Mary Burke, and now this primary election, which was disgusting. And the fig leaf they used was that these right-wing talk show hosts had all agreed to gang up on Trump. Trump voters don't change their mind. Trump voters don't listen to what some whack job on the radio was saying. It was ridiculous.
Ridiculous. And Scott Walker, of course, is fronting for the politics of scarcity. He's fronting for the Koch brothers and Soros and others who are basically trying to tell people, now we got to tighten our belts. Again, I'm not against tightening our belts if we are poor, but this idea that the union, I know a guy in the Teamsters, a friend of mine, and we went to grade school there. I spent thousands and thousands of hours playing baseball and basketball with him growing up in the schoolyard and that. And his section of the Teamsters, their pension has just been cut in half.
Yeah.
And that's allegedly.
And they're looting all the pension funds all over the country.
That's right. And that's right. And Gary Ween, who was Audie Murphy, the movie star's bodyguard, I talked to him in the last year of his life, 1999. I didn't fully grasp it when he first, he said, Jim, they're trying to get into the pensions of all the union workers, and they're going to manipulate it through the, when they invest that in the stock market, they'll be able to steal their pensions and claim that it was a bad stock market year. And that's what they've done. But yeah. He was kind of introducing me to that. He was an LA cop, by the way.
And then you don't want to put pension money in a stock market anyway.
Oh, it's absurd. So Walker is fronting for the politics of scarcity. Oh, you guys. And so you got the Tea Party who don't understand money, who think, we're they're not looking at it from what we can produce. They're looking at it from hearing, well, where are we going to get all this money? And of course, I'm not for being a spendthrift, but if you issue the money equal to the goods and services, more or less, you're not going to cause inflation. And then the people got enough money in their pocket. So you got the Tea Party not understanding money, thinking we're going to go. We need to go bankrupt, which is absurd. Although, again, this is another subject. Then you got Walker trying to slap down the unions, fronting for this politics of scarcity. Well, and that's why the powers that be that control the computers love Walker.
Walker is a completely disgusting scumbag. His first act, he turned down federal financing for high-speed rail between Milwaukee and Madison, $800 million. He turned around, took $800 million out of public education. He cracked down on the public unions. He's taken $250 million out of the University of Wisconsin system. He's promoted weakening the pollution, anti-pollution, and environmental laws. He actually got the legislation to pass that if he sells all the state's energy, this includes a nuclear power plant, for pennies, that it's in the interest of the state. He got that in law. Before he leaves, he's going to sell off all the power plants in the state to the Koch brothers for a nickel.
Well, this is another problem. I mean, I'm all for private enterprise, but certain things should not be privatized. And
he's doing his best to turn Wisconsin, which was a magnificent state when I moved down here in 2006, into the Mississippi of the Midwest.
Uh-huh.
Well, Jim, I cannot thank you enough. This has been absolutely sensational. I've already got positive feedback They're so thrilled that we're talking about election theft using voting machines. I can't thank you enough, my friend.
Well, thank you for having us. And we only got through two slides, so maybe another time.
So we'll bring you back. Maybe we'll make three. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, thanking my special guest, Jim Condit Jr., for being here, and all of you for watching.